This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Æthelstan, King of England, died on the 27th of October 939, almost 40 years to the day after his grandfather Alfred. Alfred, often called the Great, retains his place in the popular memory today as the king who defeated the Vikings and united Christian, West Saxon and Mercian Midland peoples under his rule, as well as burning the cakes. But who was Æthelstan? Æthelstan ought, in fact, to be more celebrated than Alfred. He was the first king to rule all England, uniting all the English peoples under a single authority. More than that, he claimed imperial overlordship over the whole of Britain, a feat no one man had achieved since the end of Roman rule. Æthelstan's military prowess brought him direct authority over not just the kingdoms of Wessex and Mercia, which he inherited from his father, but over all the areas in the East Midlands that had been settled by the Danes and, even more significantly, over the kingdom north of the Humber. After he conquered Northumbria in 927, Celtic rulers from elsewhere in the British Isles submitted to his authority rather than face English incursion into their realms. When the Scots king broke that treaty of friendship in 934, Æthelstan attacked Scotland with a land and sea force, ravaging as far north as Caithness and returning home to Wessex with the son of the Scots king as a hostage. A further rebellion in 937, which saw a combined force of Scots, Northumbrians and Dublin Norse converge on Mercian territory, led Æthelstan to call out the English army to battle at a place called Brunanburgh, where he achieved a resounding victory. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle marked the occasion in verse, recalling, "Never yet in this island before this was a greater slaughter of a host made by the edge of the sword, since the Angles and Saxons came hither from the east, overcame the Britons and won a country." Foreigners also recognised Æthelstan's status. He played a significant role on a European stage, forging alliances with royal and ducal houses across the territories of the former Carolingian Empire through marriage and fostering arrangements. Scholars from Britain and abroad flocked to his court, bringing books, precious gifts and the relics of the saints, to which Æthelstan showed particular devotion. His grandfather founded a dynasty. Æthelstan, who died childless, paved the way for that royal line through his brothers and nephews to govern all the English peoples. He helped to ensure their success by building an effective administrative machine to govern the expanded realm. When Æthelstan died, an Irish chronicler lamented the fall of the pillar of the dignity of the Western world. Clearly, Æthelstan was a king of considerable renown in the 10th century, so it's a mystery why he's largely forgotten in Britain today, outside the very few English towns with monuments to his memory. Understanding why Æthelstan matters and creating a picture of him as a man, not just as a military leader and royal figurehead, involves piecing together information from a disparate range of sources and a good deal of imaginative licence. We don't know when or where Æthelstan was born, nor can we be confident about the identity or background of his mother, whose name Edwin is recorded only in later medieval sources. His father Edward, nicknamed the Elder to distinguish him from other Edwards who ruled before the Norman Conquest, was Alfred's eldest son and chosen heir. Producing sons of his own was a duty for a royal prince, and Edward probably married in the early 890s. Æthelstan, his first child, may have been born around 894 if he was, as William of Malmesbury tells us, aged 30 when he became king in 924. Æthelstan will have spent his early childhood in Wessex, perhaps near his grandfather's court. A later historian recorded an occasion when King Alfred invested his young grandson with some military regalia, a cloak, a belt, a sword and a scabbard. A contemporary Latin poem, playing on the prince's name, Æthelstan, noble stone, may commemorate that event. But around the time of Alfred's death and Edward's accession to the throne in 899, Edward remarried. Thereafter, Æthelstan was sent to be brought up by his aunt, Alfred's daughter, in the Mercian kingdom. Once old enough, the prince seems to have joined his father in his wars to drive the Danish settlers out of Wessex and eastern England. But Æthelstan's place in his father's affections, and those of the West Saxon royal court, seems to have been supplanted by the eldest of the sons born to Edward's second wife. For when Edward died, the West Saxons proclaimed his second son, Alfwead, as their king, while Æthelstan was made king only over the Mercians. Alfwead's death soon after their father's in the summer of 924 prevented a permanent division of the country between the two brothers. Yet it wasn't until September the following year that Æthelstan secured his rulership over both Wessex and Mercia by having himself crowned symbolically in the town of Kingston-on-Thames on the border between the two ancient kingdoms. Æthelstan had designs on the Northumbrian kingdom early in his reign. Almost immediately after the coronation, he arranged for his full sister to marry the Danish king in York, whose name was Sigtrygg. Such an alliance was meant to protect Æthelstan's northern border, but Sigtrygg died the following year. The presence of his widowed sister in now hostile territory gave Æthelstan an excuse to march north, seize the city of York, and take control of the whole of Northumbria. Little blood may have been shed on that occasion, but there seems no question that this was a military takeover. The mere threat of military force proved enough to persuade the Celtic kings elsewhere in the island to submit. They met Æthelstan at Eyrmont in Cumbria, south of Penrith, pledged peace with oaths, and submitted to his authority. This event, widely recorded in contemporary and later chronicles, marked in formal ceremony the profound significance of Æthelstan's acquisition of direct rule over Northumbria and the change in his royal status from King of the West Saxons and Mercians to Governor of all the English peoples. In the same year, Æthelstan marched to Hereford to receive the submission of the Welsh kings also. Now he alone held sway over not just the English, but the whole island of Britain. Those in the king's immediate circle must have noticed the significance of his enhanced status. From this time on, Æthelstan was given royal titles that reflected his new position as effective over-king of Britain. In the king's written documents, his scribes stopped using his father's style, King of the Anglo-Saxons, and started to call him King of the English and Guardian or Governor of the whole island of Britain or of Albion. One draftsman even started to call him by the Greek title for the ruler of the Eastern Empire, Basileus, Emperor. Manuscripts associated with the royal circle reflected the same self-conscious awareness of the king's standing on a national stage. A poem in praise of Æthelstan copied onto a blank leaf in a gospel book opened with the words, "Holy King Æthelstan, renowned through the wide world, whose esteem flourishes and whose honour endures everywhere, whom God set as king over the English, sustained by the foundation of the throne, and as leader of his earthly forces." In another manuscript, we find a full-page illustration showing the king in the act of giving the volume to St Cuthbert. Æthelstan's stance makes him look humble, devoted and learned, his eyes cast down onto the open page of the book as if he were reading and meditating on its contents. But what's most striking about this, the earliest surviving portrait of any English king, is the fact that on his head, Æthelstan wears a crown, a simple circlet of gold from which rise vertical prongs, a sphere set on the tip of each. No previous English king had chosen the crown to symbolise his royal status, although kings in Carolingian Francia, that's modern France, had done so before. At the same time, the king began to use another medium to convey the nature of his power to an audience far beyond the literate and restricted circle of his own court – money. Soon after the submission at Eyrmont, coins minted in the king's name started to bear a new legend, Rex Tot Brit, standing for Rex Toetius Britanniae, king of all Britain. Further, Athelstan chose a new visual image to accompany that fresh text, a portrait of his own bust in profile. He's shown wearing a tunic and a Roman military cloak, and on his head, instead of the conventional royal diadem, is that same simple crown that the king had worn to visit St Cuthbert. Together with the rhetoric of his written documents, this visual symbolism asserted the imperial quality of the king's rulership over all of Britain. But it would be a mistake to think of Athelstan as a king who cared only for appearances. In extending his rule over all the English peoples in the island, he brought together under a single authority peoples many of whom had previously suffered significant political disruption and consequent social breakdown because of the Danish wars and Scandinavian settlements. Fully aware of the magnitude of the burdens laid on him at his coronation to serve as shepherd of his people, Athelstan devoted much of his energy in peacetime towards the repair and renewal of that fractured and damaged society. As well as taking close control over the minting of coins, he introduced several measures to make the governance of his extended realm work more effectively. Councils called to discuss royal business gathered leading nobles and churchmen from across all England and were attended also by the Welsh kings. His reign even saw the first moves to centralise a royal writing office for the production of written records of government. Athelstan's Christian view of the responsibilities of royal power led him to use provisions in some of his land grants and in his law codes to encourage his people to pay their tithes to the church, to make charitable donations to the poor and destitute, and regularly to say psalms and pray for the king and for the good of his realm. Various provisions in his law codes still strike us today as highly topical. The king used the law as a way of trying to break down the power of local kindreds and to protect the vulnerable, legislating repeatedly over the problem of theft. He saw theft as a major disturbance of the peace, and worse, as a crime of disloyalty to the king himself and to his office. Athelstan's concerns for his people's well-being appear also in attempts to raise the age at which criminals might face the death penalty, to introduce the idea of prison as an alternative to other sorts of punishment, and to stop trading on Sundays. That last provision didn't catch on. He was forced to revoke it later. The 12th century historian William of Malmesbury may have been right when he reported a vigorous tradition in England that Athelstan was the most law-abiding ruler the English had ever had. Despite his many achievements, Athelstan remains today a contested figure. Two contrasting images of him dominate his posthumous reputation. One of the successful warrior king who united England, subdued the other rulers of Britain and defended that wider realm from outside attack. And another of the pious king, one who collected books and the relics of the saints, was a generous patron to the English church and never married. Perhaps religious motives drove him to choose chastity. He may also have wanted to ensure that his youngest brothers could succeed him unchallenged on the English throne. Certainly, Athelstan deserves to be remembered for having first united all England under one authority. But more telling was the epithet granted him by a chronicler writing not long after his death. He celebrated a very mighty king, one worthy of honour, in whose time the fields of Britain were consolidated into one. There was peace everywhere and abundance of all things. No king since the departure of the Roman legions had held such authority. Athelstan was more than just the first king of all England. In his reign were sown the seeds from which one day would grow a kingdom of Britain.